Welcome to Worldview with me, Adam Bolton. How will demography, the study of population change, shape our future? And what can we learn from history about likely outcomes? That's what we're going to discuss with the help of leading experts on this latest episode of Worldview. Debate about population isn't new. In the 1960s and 1970s, the concern was that there were going to be too many human beings. It went mainstream. It even hit the bestseller lists.
How much has the world increased in population in say, 10 years?
Well, in 10 years, we're putting on a billion people.
That was Paul Ehrlich, the author of the hit 1968 book, The Population Bomb, being interviewed by Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show in 1980. Demographic alarmism remains, but now is projected in the opposite direction. The Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida recently told lawmakers, due to low birth rates, their nation is standing on the verge of whether it can continue to function as a society. Later, we'll discuss Japan properly with Bill Emmett, a leading commentator and former editor-in-chief of The Economist magazine. And we'll speak to Richard Ashton, the Times West Africa correspondent, about Nigeria, a country still with one of the youngest and fastest rising populations in the world. First, for an overview of the study of demographics and why they matter, I spoke to Paul Morland, one of the world's leading demographers. He's the author of a number of books, including Tomorrow's People and Demographic Engineering. So I asked him, why do demographics matter?
Well, they matter insofar as people matter. If people matter in history, then demography matters. And if people matter in the economy, then demography matters. Because demography is about how many people there are, who's getting born, who's dying, and where people are moving to.
And is it a driver of history?
I think it's a huge driver of history, underappreciated, which is very much the theme of my second book, The Human Tide. But of course, it's not in isolation of history. It's not some exogenous factor which feeds into history. It shapes history. But it is, of course, also shaped by history. Like every other historical force, it's enmeshed in the great story of our past.
I mean, does it come down to as simple as if you are the biggest tribe around, you're likely to be dominant?
There's a lot more to it than that. Numbers matter enormously, and historically, the bigger gang on the hunting field managed to get the game. The bigger army on the field would generally win. And then it's quite interesting to think, where are there exceptions? What was it about technology or organisation that allowed certain societies to be the exception to the rule? And the exception to the rule is really interesting, but that doesn't mean the rule isn't generally the bigger gang wins the prize.
So if we go into early history, prehistory, what are the big movements, the big trends you'd pick out?
OK, so imagine that an average woman had four children, which is actually fewer than most would, and each of her children survived to adulthood, and each of them had four children. In the year one, there were 250 million people on the planet. So you'd have had about 1 billion by the year 50. And by the year 500, you'd have had about 235 billion. So why did that not happen? And the reason is, as explained to us by Thomas Malthus, if war didn't get you and disease didn't get you, then the simple lack of the planet ability to create enough food was going to cause starvation. And of course, lots of people died well before they reached reproduction age. And that was really the story of a relatively random walk up to Malthus's age, whereby very slowly world population grew. We did improve our ability, our carrying capacity as a planet. And basically, between Julius Caesar and Queen Victoria, it took that long, not 50 years, but pretty much 1,800 years for the global planet to quadruple its population to 1 billion. So that's what I call demographic pre-modernity. Then you get modernity. You get the Industrial Revolution, you get the railway, you get the steamship, you get modern methods of agriculture. And the ability to feed people expands enormously. Death rates go down, people still have large families, and the population explodes. And the interesting thing is, where is that happening? First in Britain, then across Europe. Then gradually those family sizes go down, people get more urbanised and educated, and the caravan, as it were, moves on to other places. So in the middle of the 20th century, in the 1960s, 1970s, it was places like Guatemala and Kenya that were having those falls in mortality rates and those explosions of population. And meanwhile, back in Britain and other European countries, the fertility rate at that stage was much lower, sub-replacement.
And prior to that post-Enlightenment Victorian age, would it be right to say that life was pretty much nasty, brutish and short everywhere? Or were there some parts of the world where population was growing and others presumably where it was declining.
It was everywhere for most people most of the time. I mean, ironically, the exceptions are, because Malthus more or less said, we're going to push on without good contraception, which he didn't approve of anyway, we'll always push up to the limit of the world's ability to feed ourselves. And there'll be a small class of people who emerge out of that. But most people are going to be hungry most of the time. Ironically, where living standards actually rose was where you'd got something horrible happen, a terrible war or the plague. I mean, the classic case is the Black Death. And it took a long time for the population to grow back after the Black Death.
Because it actually went down, didn't it?
It went down hugely. And while it was growing, those were good times. There was more space. The technology of the world and the space of the world meant in Europe and the Middle East, you could support more people than there were. So those people lived a little bit better than they would normally have done. And of course, a la Malthus, that meant fewer of them died. Population grew, and it grew back up to that Malthusian frontier.
Now, you mentioned Malthus a lot. I suppose Scrooge is the sort of most famous Malthusian, that if people starve, they decrease the surplus population. Did that work? Can we look around the world and see that happening?
Well, it happened, but the great story of Malthus is he was right up to his day and then wrong afterwards, and wrong into the age of Dickens, say. What was happening, as I said, was that on the one hand, the world's ability to support the number of people was growing exponentially. He thought it would only grow gradually. A new technology to drain marshes, a new saddle on a horse that would gradually expand productivity of agriculture. Actually, it started to explode in the 19th century. So he was wrong about the future. And then the other thing that changed his equation was, not only was he wrong in thinking that resources would grow slowly, they exploded and have continued exploding since the era of the Industrial Revolution, but he was wrong to think that we couldn't really control our own fertility. I mean, he talked about infanticide, he talked about restraint, but he perhaps would have thought of the pill as vice. He was a clergyman of the Church of England 200 years ago. But I don't think he could have envisioned that on the one hand, we would be able to look after ourselves, feed ourselves and care for ourselves so well. And on the other hand, we would so efficiently be able to control our numbers.
But I remember even in the 1960s and 1970s, there was a lot of talk about the population explosion. Still this feeling that unless something drastic happened, the population was just going to go on and on growing.
Well, there have been Malthusians after Malthus, and they've been proved consistently wrong. So at the end of the 19th century, it felt like we'd hit another wall, and there was a lack of artificial fertilisers, and then we had the Haber-Bosch process. Half the people alive today are alive thanks to that invented in pre-World War Germany. And then the population grew relatively rapidly again, and in the 1960s, it was growing as fast as ever globally. It was growing at about 2% plus a year, and you had someone like Paul Ehrlich saying civilization's going to collapse, we're going to have mass starvation, billions of people will starve. And again, the Malthusians were proved wrong, because we had the Green Revolution, we had Borlaug, and since then we've continued to have extraordinary gains in productivity and food, so that whilst the population may have doubled over the last sort of 40, 50 years, the agricultural productivity has tripled or quadrupled, and people today, although there are 8 billion of us, are eating 3,000 calories a day rather than 2,000.
But we're also told the projection is that things will peak in this century. How does that work?
Well, what it means is we are continuing technologically to have fantastic advances in agriculture, better yields conventionally, better practice. I mean, the yields in Brazil are twice those in Cuba, so there's lots of best practice that can be adopted. And then all the new technologies of things like hydroponics and artificial meat on the one hand. And then on the other hand, the population growth is slowing and slowing and slowing. It was 2% a year back in the late 60s, early 70s. It's now under 1% a year. It will be 0.5% a year globally, I'm talking. I mean, there are obviously regional exceptions. It will be 0.5% a year within 20 or 30 years. By the end of the century, at the very latest, we will be in a position where the global population has peaked. So as the human population growth slows and slows and slows, our technological innovations continue to drive ahead, so we should be very capable of feeding everyone.
And where will that peak be?
The UN says the peak in population is going to be 2,100. Generally, demographers think it will be a bit earlier than that.
And how many people?
It's somewhere 9 or 10 billion, probably somewhere around 2060 to 2080.
So not really compared to what we've lived through over the last 50 years. I mean, actually a smaller increase.
It is growing every year a little bit less. I mean, you know, for example, the population in China is now falling, which is extraordinary. Remember, China's the biggest population in the world. It's about to be overtaken by India if it hasn't been already. And even in India, although there's a lot of population growth in the works, the fertility rate is now only a bit above 2. So India's long-term projection is downward as well.
And all this slowing in the population growth, in spite of medical advances which are keeping people alive more.
So people can stay alive, but only so long. Even the Japanese on average die at 85. So death can be delayed, but only so long. Fertility can plunge and plunge and plunge. Again, we used to say, oh, the demographic transition ends when women have 2 children or 2.2 children or something. But we now have societies where, I mean, in our own country, in Britain, we've had sub-replacement fertility, so fertility rates below what you need for long-term stability since the days of Edward Heath. And in even quite poor countries now, you're getting fertility rates down, like India, for example. And there are countries like Korea where they're recording something like 0.8 or 0.9 children per woman, which means that every cohort is half the size of the next. And that is going to be the revolutionary demography of the coming decade.
So if we go, I mean, I'll call it the age of demographics, obviously, that when people realise that it really was possible to manipulate how populations go. Do we have any examples in history where this really made a big difference?
The number of people making a difference.
Well, the sort of geopolitics of demography.
Oh, hugely. I mean, until Malthus's day, as I said, it was a bit of a random walk. But as you get into the 19th century, you could never have had the expansion of the British population, I mean the population of the British Isles, English, Scottish, Irish and Welsh, to the furthest corners of the world, from Auckland to San Francisco, English-speaking settlements, without the massive population growth in the UK. So the empire of the 19th century was a demographic phenomenon. The Americans could not have rolled over they bought Louisiana from the French, but the French had no chance of holding it. They were outnumbered 100-1. The Russians and the Germans, if you look at the ratio of those two peoples between 1914 and 1941, when the two world wars broke out, that itself tells you a lot about why the Russians managed to lose in the First World War to win in the Second World War. Well, the ratios of Russians to Germans were always higher. The population transition that I've explained happened earlier in Germany than Russia. It was more advanced. So by the time of the First World War, the population of Germany was already slowing down. In Russia, they were still having 6-7 children into the 20s and early 30s. And what that meant is there were an awful lot of young people ready for the front line in Russia. The ratios shifted decisively in favour of the Russians and against the Germans. There's a famous statement by a German general saying they just kept coming and coming. The sheer numbers of Russians were a decisive factor in 1941, 42 and on to 45. In a way, they weren't in 1914. Obviously, there were other factors. There was the strategic leadership or failures of leadership. There was what was and wasn't going on other fronts. But the sheer ratio of Russians to Germans between those two world wars was decisive. So I would say, rather than what were the big events which were driven by demography, what were the big events that weren't driven by demography?
And can we say that China and India, both of which had clear policies to keep the population down, sterilisation in India and in China, the one-child policy, were they wrong?
They were definitely wrong where they were coercive. So the first thing to say is I never believe in coercive policies. The Chinese have been proven to be wrong because they're now thinking about actually encouraging people to have bigger families. Thank goodness the Indian policy was a very limited period under the emergency in the late 70s. It was tragic, but it didn't go on for very long. Are governments in poor countries with high fertility rates wrong to get their fertility rates down? Absolutely not. It's part of development. It happens anyway. Governments can facilitate it, not with coercion, but with education for women and with contraceptive family planning projects. I think it's absolutely sensible for a country like Nigeria, for example, to try and get its fertility rate down, or Kenya and Ethiopia, which have done so successfully. Because I think when you're poor and you have very large families, it's very hard to get the economy moving. And the really successful countries, the ones with bright futures, are those with lots of people in their 20s, because of older generations having large families, who are now only having 2 or 3. So I think 2 or 3 is the golden zone. And I think governments of poor countries are quite right to try and get their fertility rates down. It should never be done through coercion. And there are times to stop those policies and actually encourage people to have more children when it gets below 2.
Nigeria is key to global demographics. It's set to become the third most populated country in the world by 2050 as its economy grows fast. I spoke to Richard Ashton, the Times and Sunday Times West African correspondent, who's written extensively on the fast-moving changes in Nigeria and West Africa. I asked him, first, just how young the population of Nigeria is.
More than 60% of Nigerians are under 25, and more than 40% are under the age of 15. So very young indeed.
And how has that come about?
Well, like lots of African countries, low education levels, low health coverage have led to very high birth rates. Nigeria doesn't have the highest birth rates in Africa or indeed the world. That's its neighbour, Niger, where each woman has just under 7 children at the moment. But Nigeria isn't far behind, with just over 5 children per woman. Those rates have actually been declining in the last few decades, but simply by virtue of the fact that Nigeria is already so populous. It's the most populous country in Africa. More than 1 in 5 Africans is Nigerian. The numbers relating to its population growth are very stark. So by 2050, the country is projected to have a population of 400 million people, making it the third most populous country in the world. If you keep going forward, some studies suggest that by the end of the century, Nigeria might have more people than China. Lagos alone will be the most populous city in the world, perhaps with as many as 80 million people.
And presumably medical science has played a part in this as well, that children are surviving much more.
Yeah, absolutely. The World Health Organization reported last year on a big 20-year assessment of life expectancy in African countries and showed that, on the whole, on average, life expectancy has grown by about 10 years in that time. So Africa is starting to catch up with the rest of the world. One of the big differences, fewer babies are dying, so infant mortality has gone down.
And how are people viewing this, what is, I think you can generally call this, a population boom in Nigeria? Is it a source of concern or a source of national pride?
That's a very good question. We've just had an election recently in Nigeria, and this has not been an issue that I've seen discussed anywhere. Nigeria has been wholly preoccupied with many security crises, with economic woes that have got worse in the last decade. And basically, people are too worried about putting food on the table to spend too much time thinking about 30 years down the line. Having said that, these crises and the population pressure that's coming from this boom in people is already putting huge pressure on these issues that are being discussed. So if you look at insecurity in the north of Nigeria, for example, the Boko Haram crisis that has spawned various other insurgencies, that is in large part because there are more people competing for fewer resources. Farmland is decreasing, and tensions between herding populations and farming populations are a huge factor in why there's been so much conflict. So yes, Nigeria should be spending more time talking and thinking about these issues, but at the moment it just isn't.
And what are the projections? I mean, will Nigeria be able to feed and house and educate a population growing at the rate that it is growing?
Projections aren't good. China is a good example of a country that has done well out of massive population growth in recent history, in large part because it had what demographers call a population dividend, meaning there are more people of working age than there are dependent on them. In Nigeria, the opposite is the case. So there are so many young people that productivity hasn't increased. Nigeria is already competing with India for the stakes of having the highest number of poor people in the world under World Bank definitions. It's also a country where it has the highest number of children out of school. Unemployment stands at about 30%. Youth unemployment is about 40%. And that's the situation now. So unless Nigeria finds a way to make itself more productive in the coming decades, presumably by those metrics, the situation will only get worse.
And in cultural terms, has it become a young people's culture? I mean, do people grow old? How are they viewed and treated?
I mean, traditionally, in the south of Nigeria, particularly where I live, which is majority Yoruba, the culture is veneration of older people, and extended families have always been strong, and that still is the case. I think one thing to say is, as these trends have developed, it's almost as if young people in Nigeria are starting to live in a different universe to their elders, to their parents and grandparents. Politically, Nigeria is a gerontocracy where leaders have been in their 70s for a good while. The median age is so much lower. The median age is 18. In particularly in urban areas, technology has come on a lot. So more and more Nigerians are not just owning smartphones, but it's starting to govern their lives much more like the West. You know, if you go to a big concert in December in Lagos, for example, and are surrounded by a kind of sea of faces watching some of the big Nigerian stars now, it's a country that has changed so much from, you know, half a century ago.
It's also presumably a big consumer market being targeted by international brands.
Yeah, that's right. Beer is a good example of this. In Nigeria, the market's been growing by about 10% annually for 20 years. And the big global brewers are all stepping in, buying up Nigerian breweries and waging these beer wars with each other, with the result that everywhere you look, there is beer and beer marketing. One example on alcohol as well, Pernod Ricard, the French drinks giant, which is the second largest wine and spirits company in the world, has gone so far as to fund an entire youth subculture in Nigeria. It's known as Alte, and it's short for alternative, and it's visible in the fashion sense now of some of the biggest pop stars who are storming world charts, like Burna Boy, for example. What Pernod Ricard realised was that there was this burgeoning youth subculture in particularly Lagos. And so what they decided to do was just promote this youth subculture, sponsor events and concerts, and they're often attended by the trendiest young Nigerians. So, yeah, corporate giants are definitely alive to the opportunities.
And what about the geopolitics of this? With this burgeoning young population, does it sort of kindle Nigeria's ambitions for a greater role on the world stage and within Africa?
Well, I think Nigeria has always felt like the natural leader of Africa, and I think it's rankled when
countries South Africa or Kenya might dispute
exactly
that.
Exactly. I think depending how things go in the next decade, certainly Nigeria will start to throw its weight around on the international stage a bit more. When it came to the war in Ukraine recently, other African countries very visibly declined to condemn the invasion by Russia. Nigeria has been more in line with the West. It remains to be seen. Nigeria, certainly at the moment, it is odd that it has such a large cultural footprint in the world, but does not have the same political heavyweight status.
I mean, it all sounds, you know, to use a journalistic cliche, it all sounds a bit like a powder keg. Would that be the way to see it?
Yes, and no, only because Nigeria does have an extraordinary knack for muddling on. Having said that, there are analysts that I speak to and experts, you know, who really know the country well, and Nigerians as well, who just ask how much further the country can go down the path it's currently taken before something really calamitous happens. You know, certainly the stakes are very, very high.
The stakes are similarly high in Japan, even if the story is very different. Last year, fewer than 800,000 babies were born in Japan. Meanwhile, 1.5 million people died. So why is Japan such a stark example, and what happened? Bill Emmett is former editor-in-chief of The Economist and the author of several books, the latest being Japan's Far More Female Future. How does he view Japan's demographics conundrum?
There are two demographic questions for Japan. One is a declining population. Essentially, their population, around 127 million people, so pretty large, is now declining by 750,000 a year and rising. And therefore, there are questions about the impact, particularly on rural Japan, on social functions, on payment of tax and so forth of a declining population. But the second demographic issue, which obviously relates to that, is the aging of the population. When I lived in Japan in the 1980s as a correspondent for The Economist, one of Japan's advantages competitively was that it had had a huge post-war baby bulge, even vaster than the baby booms of America or Europe, and as a result had a relatively young population, relatively cheap, therefore, to employ. That all changed as the birth rate dropped and as life expectancy extended, and now nearly 30% of the population, just below that, are over the age of 65, and more than 75,000 centenarians. And that has just biased the population towards the older age groups, which has an impact on voting patterns, a very strong conservative bias among the older voters, but also on employment. Because although Japan actually has quite a high employment rate among the over 65s compared with other places, obviously most of them are in retirement and out of the workforce. And thirdly, it has an impact on public finances because it has fewer taxpayers and more people drawing pensions.
So how does Japan treat its elderly population? I mean, can it afford it?
It treats its elderly population extremely well. Pensions are adequate, good, not so much if you're reliant only on public pensions. Private pensions, corporate pensions are pretty generous, and that keeps people going. Secondly, during COVID, I had a real worry that just as we were seeing in Italy, old population, there would be a very high mortality rate, particularly early on before we had vaccinations, among the elderly. Japan actually never had that. The reason it didn't is because its care homes are actually pretty well protected, very well set up, and they were very much better able to protect the elderly from the virus. So they do look after the elderly well, and I think the elderly in general enjoy their lives, particularly because they are relatively healthy, thanks to the Japanese diet and to exercise. But there are real problems, particularly with high rates of dementia, but most of all, the low birth rate, which is just sort of skewing the population and causing some worries.
And what are the explanations for the low birth rate? I mean, one might have expected in the past that a post-war baby boom would beget another baby boom.
In part, Japan has followed what I think a lot of developed countries have done, which is, you know, as people have got wealthier and relatively more secure, they've decided to have fewer babies. But most of all, I think the problem is actually to do with marriage and Japanese culture. Essentially, very, very few babies are born outside wedlock in Japan. There is a very strong social stigma. At the same time, an increasing number of both men and women actually have decided not to get married. And this has happened principally, I would say, because of insecurity in the workplace, at least, after the bursting of Japan's sort of financial bubble and the slowdown of its economy in the 1990s and 2000s. A lot of workers, particularly younger ones, became more insecure. They felt they were unable to borrow money to buy houses, to set up mortgages, and therefore to form families. And that insecurity, which has come with a lot of short-term work, the zero-hours contracts, has discouraged both men and women from making the commitment to marriage and as a result to having children.
Has this resulted in tension between the generations?
In Japan, tension is quite a difficult thing to detect. Japan's a very conformist society. Japan's a place where strikes and other demonstrations take place at lunchtime in order not to inconvenience too many people. It's hard to view the tension. And there is a fair amount of intergenerational transfers of money, houses of inheritance, the sharing of pensions between the better of old and perhaps their grandchildren that eases the tensions. But there has been an increase in poverty, and you know, certainly among younger people there is discontent.
Could we talk about, if you like, the cultural impact of having an aging population? I suppose that's because a lot of people seeing Japan and indeed Europe and the United States of having a cult of youth and beauty.
I think that Japan too has a cult of beauty, at least, and it's a culture that has always loved children. But as the gradual change towards an aging population has also come, Japan has, if like, embraced its grey hair. When I was starting my book on Japanese women, the first person I thought to interview was actually a 103-year-old female artist who had her first public exhibition actually in 1940. There's a woman called Toko Shinoda. She, at the age of 103, had published a book which had sold 500,000 copies. Her art dealer said, "I don't know if you're impressed by that, Bill, because you're an author." And I said, "I certainly am impressed by that. I think I need to meet this lady." So I went and met her. She actually passed away 2 years ago at the age of 106, but she was still producing art right up until the last months of her life. And I think that sort of person, who is also celebrated somewhat on Japanese television, which is why her book had sold so many copies, has become something of a cult figure in Japan, and a representative image for the rest of society, a sense that things can be achieved at any stage in life, a leading tone setter in art.
Why did you call your book Japan's Far More Female Future?
I called it that because Japan has been a very patriarchal society with a lagged process of women catching up. But during the 1990s and 2000s, the number of women going to full four-year education, university courses absolutely ballooned. This means that there's going to be a new supply of professionally educated women to getting into leadership positions. And thanks to the aging of population and the declining birth rate, Japan needs it. And so I think because of the labor shortage that comes with demographic change, the face of Japan, corporate Japan, governmental Japan, probably media Japan too, is going to become much more female. And that's what I thought was an interesting thing to look at for my book.
Population change can be hard to predict, but with some luck and forward thinking, it's something with which we can cope. Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The Worldview series editor is Murray Jessel, the producer is Eve Webster, and the sound engineer Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Until next time, thanks for listening.